Good afternoon, everyone. Welcome to the White House. My name is Karen Richardson with the White House Office of Public Engagement. Today we're here to discuss the President's trip to the United Nations General Assembly. Today we'll be taking a variety of questions on a variety of issues that the President discussed at the UN this week. You can participate in this discussion as it's being live streamed on whitehouse.gov. You can participate via the White House Facebook application or on Twitter at hashtag WHChat. With me is my colleague, Ben Rhodes, who is the Deputy National Security Advisor for Strategic Communications. Ben will be here to answer your questions. And I guess with that, I will turn it over to Ben, who can provide a brief update, and then we can jump right into questions.
Sure. Well, we'll move to your questions. I'll just say a couple opening comments about the President's 2 days in New York at the UN. The first day, we really focused on two international issues that the U.S. has put a lot of time and attention into. The first is Libya. At a meeting that the President requested, over 60 nations came together to express support for the new Libyan government. And this really represents the culmination of a first phase of time in which the UN played a key role in supporting the aspirations of the Libyan people. The United States joined a military operation to prevent the slaughter of thousands of civilians in Libya, and then continued to enforce the protection of civilians over the course of the next several months, while the Libyan people took the step of ending the Gaddafi regime. And what happened earlier this week is a new Libyan government was welcomed as a member of the United Nations. And then at that meeting that the President attended, along with, again, over 60 leaders, they discussed the Libyan government's plans for an inclusive and democratic transition going forward, the role of the United Nations going forward in supporting that transition, and there's a UN office in the Libyan capital of Tripoli. And then the U.S. discussed the role we would play in providing support to a democratic transition in Libya, including the President announcing that our embassy would open this week in Tripoli. And that took place yesterday as the U.S. flag went up over the embassy in Tripoli. Another meeting that the President hosted, co-hosted earlier this week was on open government. Last year at the UN, he called upon nations around the world to make commitments to pursue open government, transparency mechanisms that ensure that you can combat corruption, that citizens can petition their governments, they can hold officials accountable. And what happened is 8 countries came forward with concrete commitments earlier this week, co-hosted by the United States and Brazil, but then dozens of other countries committed to join this partnership. So what we want to do is work with governments and civil society organizations around the world, again, to use open government as a tool of promoting democracy and more accountable governance. The President also had a range of bilateral meetings over the course of 2 days that included a meeting with a new Prime Minister of Japan, meeting with the leaders of France and the United Kingdom to talk about the global economy and Middle East peace, meeting with the new President of South Sudan, which is the newest member state of the United Nations, something the U.S. supported for a very long time, and again, a meeting with the Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu and the President of the Palestinian Authority, Mahmoud Abbas. The Israeli-Palestinian issue, of course, is always one of great interest to the UN, and I'm sure some of your questions may address that, but we again expressed our support for a two-state solution to the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, but one that is negotiated between Israelis and Palestinians and not pursued at the UN exclusively. The President also was able to meet with the Prime Minister of Turkey, Prime Minister Erdogan, to discuss the Arab Spring, as well as other issues related to our alliance with Turkey. So it was a very busy couple of days. But with that, I'd be happy to take any questions you have about the President's trip to the UN or any other foreign policy issues.
Thank you, Ben. We'll start with a question from the BetterWorld.org. What is the most important reason why the U.S. should engage in the UN?
Well, I think it's a very important question. And I think that the way we look at the UN is it's an indispensable organization. And every year you're reminded of that when you go to the UN. There's no other venue that brings together essentially every nation in the world to provide a forum for collective action and for dialogue. I think the most important reason for the U.S. to engage the UN is frankly that it very much advances U.S. interests to have that kind of forum where you can share the burden. The UN provides, again, a venue for burden sharing on a range of issues. So for instance, whether it's development issues, for instance, the UN plays a critical role through the World Health Organization, through a number of its other humanitarian organizations, in doing things that, again, no other body can do, and leveraging resources from across the international community, having the legitimacy of operating under that UN flag. And I think the American people need to understand that the UN fills gaps in some of the more difficult areas around the world through its, again, component agencies, whether it's dealing with refugees or health or hunger or peacekeeping, that again, is indispensable to our own interests and to global interests in peace and security. And again, I think as the president said at the UN too, the initial mandate of the UN to help enforce peace and security around the world, to both prevent and resolve conflicts, is something that we depend upon. And Libya was an example where the UN and the international community acted as exactly as it should. Faced with a critical threat to peace and security, the UN Security Council sanctioned the Gaddafi regime, then authorized the use of force to prevent what would have been an atrocity of unthinkable proportions if Gaddafi had been allowed to overrun his people. And the end result of that action is that in 6 months, a dictatorship of over four decades was ended, many lives were saved, the Libyan people were given a chance to determine their own future in a way that they never would have been able to without the support of the international community. So the UN, again, provides an indispensable venue to both advance the interests of the United States and the interests of, frankly, human beings everywhere through the actions that it undertakes every day around the world, and also provides a venue to act through the Security Council and other vehicles to ensure that we're enforcing international law and standing up for global peace and security.
Thank you. Our next question is from Stephen Morris. It's a similar question to Danielle Stuck. What action can be taken to motivate the Israeli government to resolve the statement with Palestinians over the two-state issue? Relatedly, Mr. President, why do you believe that the Palestinian appeal to the United Nations for statehood is contradictory to the ongoing peace negotiation process?
Sure. Well, our view is that, again, there needs to be a two-state solution with an independent Palestine living side by side with a secure Israel. We think that that should be negotiated between the parties because they're the ones who are going to have to live together. The United Nations cannot impose a peace upon the parties themselves, because issues like what are the borders of a potential Palestinian state, what are the security assurances associated with that so that Israel knows it can live in peace, what is the future, again, of Jerusalem going to be, what is the future of the Palestinian refugee issue going to be. These are issues that only Israelis and Palestinians can work out together. And if the Israelis are excluded from that process through a unilateral action of the United Nations, it won't achieve a Palestinian state. It won't achieve the peace that both sides, again, need and deserve going forward. So that's why we very much support a process of negotiation as opposed to a process of seeking a Palestinian statehood at the United Nations. And in terms of the Israelis, I think, again, the point that the president has made repeatedly is the United States is a close friend of Israel, has an unshakable commitment to its security. Part of that commitment is the pursuit of peace, because it's in Israel's interest for there to be a two-state solution. It's in Israel's interest, again, for the Palestinians to achieve a state, because that's how they're going to secure long-term security and peace for the people of Israel. And then if you look at a number of trends, whether they're demographic trends, trends in the international community, the fact is Israel's security would be enhanced by establishing, again, a final achievement of a two-state solution going forward.
Great. Our next question is from Khaled. Where does U.S. policy stand toward ending dictatorship in Yemen?
Well, the U.S. position is very clear. We want to see a peaceful transition of power. We want to see President Saleh agree to step aside and move on and allow for a transition to elections as soon as possible. You heard the president say at the U.N. that the people of Yemen deserve, again, to move beyond a corrupt system and deserve the democracy that they're demanding. So we've called for that peaceful transition of power. We've called for elections to take place as soon as possible after there's a transition of power. And there's an agreement that was negotiated and put forward by the Gulf states, the countries in the region, that allows for a process, again, of President Saleh stepping aside, yielding power, and then moving towards elections. And the United States very much supports that agreement and supports that type of process. Right now, it's a very challenging situation with President Saleh traveling back to Yemen today, with tensions being very high in that country. And what we want to see is a reduction of those tensions. We want to see a process of breaking the political impasse in Yemen, and again, seeing that transition move forward so the people of Yemen can determine their own future through elections as soon as possible.
Great. Our next question is from Don Kraus, who says, it was great the president called for a strong Security Council resolution on Syria. Even if Russia or China choose to veto this motion, a strong majority vote by other Security Council members will send a clear message to President Assad and his cronies that they will inevitably face consequences for their actions. What is the timeline and next steps for this resolution?
It's a great question. The president did call for this type of resolution. And what we've seen over the course of the last several months is President Assad completely lose his legitimacy, continue to crack down on his people, killing thousands of Syrians, standing in the way of the future that they want. So the United States has called for President Assad to step aside. We've imposed essentially the toughest sanctions we can possibly impose on the Syrian regime. We've worked with the Europeans, again, to expand those sanctions so that the Europeans are pursuing similar measures, which have a real impact on the Syrian government's ability to fund itself to carry out this crackdown. But we also want to see broader international action. So we're pursuing a resolution at the Security Council that, again, would strongly condemn the type of actions that the Syrian government has taken, and that should take the type of some of the types of sanctions we pursued and multilateralize them further. Now, thus far, we've not been able to accomplish this resolution. We were able to get a statement out of the UN Security Council, but we'd like to see something stronger. So what we're pursuing in New York right now is negotiations towards such a resolution. Again, one that makes it clear that we stand with the Syrian people, that we oppose the crackdown that's taking place, and that there has to be consequences for President Assad's regime. There has been opposition to date, but I think with every day that goes by, we're going to continue to make this case. We're going to continue to press it, and we're going to continue to try to have the international community speak in a unified way that what's going on in Syria is unacceptable. And even as those negotiations are ongoing, though, we're going to act on our own, and we're going to act with the Europeans and other like-minded countries to impose sanctions on our own and to make sure that those sanctions are harmonized across borders. So we'll continue to pursue the UN track, we'll continue to pursue our own pressure mechanisms, and we'll continue to work with other countries, including countries in the region, to figure out how we can support the Syrian opposition as they, again, coalesce and give voice to the aspirations of the Syrian people.
Great. Our next question is from KK, who asks, how is genocide prevention and conflict intervention advancing the U.S. national interests?
Well, I'd say there are a number of answers to that question. First of all, acts of mass atrocity, be they genocide, of course, in the most acute instance, or widespread massacres of tens of thousands of civilians, in the first instance, it just challenges our conscience. And I think many in the United States, frankly, were very disturbed by events in the recent past when we were unable to prevent these types of atrocities, whether it was in Rwanda or Darfur or in the Balkans in the 1990s. So what we want to see is the ability for the international community to take steps to prevent those types of atrocities. And that's what we did in Libya. We had a very clear instance of a government advancing steadily on major population centers in the country, including Benghazi, a city of 700,000 people, where Gaddafi said he was going to go door to door and essentially massacre his own people, and you could have had tens of thousands of people killed. Knowing that that was the case, knowing that that was likely to happen within a matter of days, we took action. Now, that's also in our interest in a number of ways. You know, if you look at, again, the humanitarian interest, it's clear, but there are also national security interests. When you have massacres like that, it feeds large flows of refugees across borders. It can destabilize whole regions. It can inflame and radicalize populations. In the particular instance of Libya, it also would have stopped the tide of democratic change in the region and reversed it. Again, right in between the countries of Egypt and Tunisia that had democratic transitions, you would have had a dictator overrunning his own people and sending a message that brute force by a dictator is stronger than the will of the people. And that's not in our interest either. So again, I think in all of these instances where there's actions of genocide or mass atrocity, we have a moral interest in taking action to stop that from taking place. But we also, in many of these instances, have a very real national security interest in not seeing massive flows of refugees and not seeing failed states that can be incubators of terrorism and conflict, and not seeing populations radicalized. So again, I think we evaluate these types of instances on a case-by-case basis about what tools of U.S. policy can be used to prevent these types of massacres. Libya was the most extreme example where you had a military operation. In other instances, we might impose sanctions. We might try to provide humanitarian assistance. We might work diplomatically through the UN and other regional organizations to stop this type of activity. But it's something that we're very committed to around the world, And it's something that, again, is, I think, very much in both our moral interest and our national security interest.
Great. Our next question is from Clayton Banks. U.S. Secretary of State Hillary Clinton talked about the role of women in peace in the Middle East. What specifically can be done to encourage that, and how receptive are the countries to that goal?
Well, we have a basic belief that countries, and it's a belief backed up by facts, that countries that allow women to reach their full potential are ultimately more successful. They're more successful economically, they're more successful politically. Again, because excluding 50% of the population from full participation in education, in the economy, and in governance is denying a country a real principal resource that it should be tapping into. So what the United States does is a number of things, again, to promote the rights of women and girls around the world. Some of that involves advocacy, advocating on a bilateral basis with countries and through multilateral forums for greater rights for women. And the president made a call in his UN speech to the General Assembly for each nation in that room to come back the next year with concrete commitments and steps that they would take to advance the empowerment of women and girls. Then we also engage in direct assistance to support these efforts. A lot of our global health initiative, for instance, is focused on the health of mothers and children, child and maternal health. Again, because one of the great impediments in the developing world to women is, again, the challenge that they face in the healthcare arena. Another way that we can do this is to empower civil society organizations that work on behalf of women's rights and women's potential. So we do a lot of programming around the world that supports that type of activity where women are able to organize and find their voice within societies. So the U.S. will continue to speak up for these things. We'll continue, again, to provide direct support to development initiatives, be they on child and maternal health or other things that advance the cause of women around the world. And we'll try to work with, again, bottom-up organizations, civil society organizations and NGOs in different places that, again, can be a voice, a powerful voice for women. And then the last thing is we'd like to see women have greater representation in some of these international organizations as well. And that's something that we've worked through with groups like UN Women, which is a very positive initiative led by Michelle Bachelet, the former president of Chile. So I think this we see this as something that's in the U.S. interest, but again, it's also in the interest of countries around the world to tap into the potential of their full population, including women.
Great. Our next question is from at Fake Consultant, who asks, how is the U.S. relationship with Turkey? What could we do better?
Well, I think we have a very positive and constructive relationship with Turkey. And President Obama has a very positive personal relationship with Prime Minister Erdogan that allows us to address a range of issues. Now, if you look at the full scope of U.S.-Turkish relations, there are issues where we have strong agreement and alignment, and then there are issues where we sometimes disagree. But if you look at the bilateral meeting that they had the other day, for starters, they were able to celebrate the agreement that was recently reached to place a part of a radar that is going to be part of the NATO missile defense system in Turkey, again, signaling Turkey's commitment to the NATO alliance and the critical role it plays as a treaty ally of the United States. Then they were also able to discuss the Arab Spring. And there, I think you see strong alignment between the U.S. and Turkey in countries like Libya, where Turkey has played a role in supporting the effort, again, to protect Libyan civilians, provide humanitarian assistance, and now to support a post-Gaddafi transition. Turkey's also played a role in Syria and speaking out more and more forcefully against the Assad regime, which is very powerful given that Turkey is, again, Syria's neighbor and has a lot of influence in the region. So there, Turkey's been able, again, to be a voice for change, to be a voice for the democratic aspirations of the Syrian people, and also to, frankly, be a place where the Syrian opposition has at times been able to come together as well. So they were, we've been able to discuss with them matters related to Syria as well. Then there have been issues, again, where we've had, again, to have some very candid conversations on Middle East peace, we have had a difference. We, of course, opposed the Palestinian effort to achieve a unilateral statehood at the United Nations. Turkey has been a supporter of those efforts. We'd also like to see a reduction in the tensions between Turkey and Israel, who are both allies of the United States. We worked and supported for some time a reparation of those relations between Turkey and Israel. That has not come about yet. But again, what we'd like to see is, again, a reduction of those tension, a reduction in the rhetoric, and, again, see two close friends and allies of the United States repair their relations, which is in their interest, we believe, and also in the interest of regional stability. So again, I think we were able to work with Turkey on issues related to NATO, whether it be alliance issues like our missile defense system or ongoing efforts in Afghanistan. We've been able to work closely with Turkey as a democracy in the Middle East and North Africa, again, as a neighbor, to support the democratic aspirations of people in the region. And we're trying to work constructively, again, to repair those relations with Israel that have been a source of tension in recent weeks.
Great. Our next question is from at OU Stand. How will the administration work with the Atrocities Prevention Board to ensure that genocide prevention remains a priority for the U.S. government going forward?
We pursued a new initiative with a presidential directive to establish a board that would ensure that we were prioritizing action that can be taken to prevent genocide and mass atrocities. So you'd have people in different parts of the government tasked with this effort. Here at the NSC, at the White House, in this administration for the first time, we have a director who's charged with the responsibility of the prevention of mass atrocities. And then across the government and the State Department and other agencies, again, we have a board that allows for coordination so that different agencies can make sure that they're, again, bringing their resources to bear in instances where we want to prevent mass atrocity, genocide. And I think what we want to do is a number of things. First of all, we want to have an early warning system where we're closely monitoring those situations where there might be, again, the ingredients for a potential mass atrocity, mass human rights violations. So again, there has to be a built-in system in the U.S. government that is monitoring those types of activities. Secondly, in those instances where that's the case, we need to evaluate what are the tools are that we have to affect that. What steps can we take to prevent that kind of mass killing or suffering? Sometimes it's going to be very strong punitive measures. Again, in Libya was the most extreme example of a military operation. In other areas, it might be just bringing this to greater attention in the international community, pursuing diplomatic initiatives, pursuing initiatives to isolate those who might be prepared to carry out these types of atrocities, to sanction them, to again, restrict their movements, to spotlight them in international organizations like the UN Human Rights Council or other places. So that you're taking action on the front end to put people on notice that the world is watching, that there'll be consequences to these types of actions. And then in other instances, we may have to provide assistance to those who are in need. A lot of times these types of tragedies take place not just when there's the killing of people, but when there's the denial of resources to people. So that if you can get humanitarian assistance to those in need, work with international bodies to do that, you can save a lot of lives. But basically what we want to see is the ability within the U.S. government to spotlight when these types of things might take place, to evaluate what tools exist within the U.S. government to act, and then to work internationally and on a multilateral basis so that the international community is meeting its responsibility to prevent these types of mass atrocities.
Great. The next question comes from Rob Moore, who asks, In President Obama's 2011 UNGA speech, he mentioned that if Iran and North Korea continued on a path outside of international law, it would be met with further pressure and isolation. My question then is whether or not the Obama administration foresees any diplomatic communication between the U.S. and Iran to bring Iran further in line with international law and agreements regarding its nuclear program and its human rights record. If Iran does stay on this path outside the realm of international law, how would the Obama administration seek to further isolate and apply pressure to it?
Well, we've always been open to diplomacy with the Iranian government. At the beginning of the administration, we pursued discussions about, its nuclear program and the steps that it could take to come in line with international law and international obligations. We even put a proposal on the table that would have allowed it to access, type of peaceful nuclear power that could be useful in terms of medical care and other fields that could be walled off from the potential to make a nuclear weapon. The Iranian government rebuffed those efforts. And I think when they did that, it demonstrated to the world that they were the source of the tension, they were the source of the problem, that they refused, good faith efforts to allow them to access peaceful power without pursuing a nuclear weapon. So therefore, we acted with the international community to impose the strongest sanctions that have ever been placed on the Iranian government. A UN sanctions regime, unilateral US sanctions, coordinated sanctions with many other nations. Those have had a real impact to date on the Iranian economy, which has slowed down to the point that it's not growing at all, and it's frankly in the most significant has facing the most significant challenges it has in decades. So we believe that the sanctions are having a real bite on the Iranian government. However, again, the fundamental offer still stands, that if the Iranian government is willing to come to the table and to take steps to show the peaceful nature of its nuclear program and to come in line with international obligations, it can have a different relationship with the United States and with the international community, one that allows its people to live up to their potential, that, again, potentially lifts those sanctions if, as the Iranian government takes steps to demonstrate that it's in line with international obligations. But they've not yet done so. So therefore, we're going to continue to look for ways to increase the pressure. We have, again, ratcheted up our sanctions steadily so that the Iranian government cannot evade those measures. And we'll continue to work with others to do that going forward. So basically, we presented a choice that's been ongoing. Continue down the path of being outside of international law, outside of your international obligations, and you'll face steadily mounting sanctions, diplomatic isolation, and pressure. Come into line with your international obligations, and you can have a different course and a different relationship with the United States and the international community. That's the course we'd like the Iranian government to take, but they've yet to take it.
All right, the next question is from Daniel Ferguson, who says, I think the big question Americans and the world have is, what does a win look like in the Middle East? It seems like even when we win, we lose in another way. So what does a real win look like, and how do we accomplish it?
Well, in terms of, the question refers to the Middle East, which could either, is often shorthand for the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. Of course, I'll also refers to the region. So I'll address both. In terms of the Middle East peace, I think a win is clear, and that is a two-state solution, a secure Israel living side by side with an independent Palestine. And frankly, the outlines of what that looks like are well known to people. And when the president put forward, again, two principles that could be the basis for negotiations going forward, they were certain security assurances for Israel so that it could know that could defend itself in the context of any solution. And similarly, the territorial basis for the Palestinian state, being 1967 borders plus mutually agreed swaps, land swaps between the parties to account for the last 40 years. And so a win is clear. It's the Palestinian people living in their own state with clearly defined borders, able to realize their aspirations, and the Israeli people living, again, in their own state, the Jewish state, which is the homeland of the Jewish people, where they are able to live in a kind of security that they haven't had over the course of many years. I think in the region more generally, a win is the advance of the type of democratic principles that people have been pursuing in Egypt, in Tunisia, in Libya, in Syria, and other places. In Libya, I think we have the potential to see that type of action take place, for instance. We've had the end of the Gaddafi regime. We have a new government established that's pursuing an inclusive transition that's moving to elections. Now they'll face huge challenges. And nobody should think that there's not going to be ups and downs and bumps in the road in all of these countries that are pursuing transitions to democracy, whether it's Egypt, Tunisia, Libya, or other countries, most acutely right now in Yemen and Syria. But I think what we want to see is a type of stability in the region that also allows the people of the region to achieve their aspirations through transitions to democracy in countries, again, like the ones that have already pursued that path, Egypt, Tunisia, Libya. So again, we believe that the region can move to a new future, one where there's a type of stability that's more lasting, that's grounded in people being able to access opportunity, access democracy, again, with that two-state solution, Israel and Palestine, moving beyond what has been a very difficult period of history and chapter of history in the region.
Great. The next question is from Troy Hawkins, who asks, why is the president running up the U.S. debt in Libya when we have so many problems at home? He criticized Bush rightfully for getting involved in Iraq when Afghanistan was not complete. We are fighting on two fronts. Can we really afford more debt?
Well, I think that the premise of the question is not entirely correct in that Libya was fully budgeted within the existing Pentagon budget. So there was no pursuit of supplemental funds to fund the effort in Libya. It came out of existing money, existing budget. So in that way, it's not adding to the U.S. debt because it's being taken from, again, what was already authorized spending for the Department of Defense. And frankly, precisely because of your concern, which the president shares, I think, you know, the question rightly points to the fact that we don't want to be overly extending ourselves abroad when we need to be nation building at home. Precisely because of that, the president very much limited the nature of the U.S. commitment in Libya. We put no boots on the ground in Libya. The bulk of our military efforts were in the first days, and then were transitioned to other countries to carry the burden going forward. And again, we limited our participation to certain types of assets so that we wouldn't be running up a huge tab. And if you look at, frankly, the cost of the Libyan operation to the United States, whereas the Iraq war is going to end up costing us $1 trillion, the Libyan operation to date has been roughly $1 billion. An incalculable difference in terms of costs. So again, we've been very vigilant about not having a huge expenditure of taxpayer resources such that we've been able to do it within the existing budget. Similarly, a lot of the funding that we're going to be able to provide going forward for the democratic transition in Libya is not American money at all. It's money that was frozen from the Gaddafi regime. When we sanctioned the Gaddafi regime, there was about $37 billion in assets that we found in U.S. banks and U.S., again, possession. That money doesn't belong to us, it belongs to the Libyan people. So what we're going to be doing is releasing chunks of those funds going forward to support the Libyan government. That, too, will keep the cost down. So again, we very much share the sentiment of the question that we want to limit expenditures in these efforts abroad. Frankly, we want to see dramatic reductions in them. And in Iraq, for instance, we've gone from spending well over $100 billion a year to cutting that dramatically down. But in Libya, again, I don't think you're going to see anywhere near the scale of expenditure. Because frankly, again, whereas we spent about $1 trillion in Iraq and Libya, this has been something budgeted within DOD that's been roughly $1 billion.
Great. The next question is from Devin Chafee. During his speech at the UN, President Obama noted the importance of getting aid to the victims of the famine in the Horn of Africa. Current administration policy continues to obstruct aid coming from non-U.S. funded entities. Will the administration issue a general license to facilitate the provision of aid by organizations that do not receive funding from the U.S.?
Well, I think we've taken steps, again, to address this challenge. We want organizations to get aid. We want organizations to be able to get assistance to those in need. A lot of the precautions that were in place were to try to prevent assistance from falling into the hands of Al-Shabaab, a terrorist organization that has actually obstructed efforts to get assistance to those in need. But OFAC has issued licenses, again, to those organizations that it is working with to get assistance to those in need in Somalia. And I think if you go to the website of the Treasury Department and OFAC, you'll see very clear clear guidelines about how the licensing procedure works to support those organizations that can get assistance into Somalia. As a general matter, we've pre-positioned resources in the region. We've increased our own funding for those efforts. We've tried to work with other countries so that they're committing resources as well. We're working with international organizations like the UN and NGOs as well to support their efforts to get assistance to those in need. So we, again, want to be working on many fronts to try to save as many lives as we can. But in terms of the specific licensing question, it's one that we've relaxed the restrictions that were in place precisely because of the desire to get as much assistance in as possible. And I think you'll see the specifics of those changes in our policy spelled out at the Treasury and OFAC websites.
Aaron House asks, there's a lot of talk about Afghanistan and Iraq. When can we expect to end war in Libya?
Well, frankly, the U.S. commitment in Libya is very limited at this point. We, again, in the first days, carried out the majority of the strikes on Libya, but then transitioned to NATO and its partners taking the lead. At this point, the U.S. is fully in a support role. We provide things like logistical support, refueling for planes. That said, even that effort we believe to end very soon. NATO just rolled over, extended its mandate to protect civilians in Libya by another 90 days, but it also made clear that it wants to end those operations as soon as possible. as soon as it believes the Libyan opposition is fully consolidated to control the country and there's no longer a risk faced by civilians. And that could happen very soon. And at that point, the U.S. role will be, which is already again now limited, will be over in terms of a military support to the NATO-led coalition. So again, as the remaining Gaddafi strongholds, which are very few, it's only really two or three places in the country, as those come under control of the opposition forces, we believe that the NATO mission will be complete in terms of the protection of civilians. And at that point, essentially, the military portion of this will be over. But again, as long as there is a threat, NATO wanted to make it clear that they'll continue to provide the civilian protection cover that they have. But people should be clear that the U.S. role here has been limited throughout in terms of no military boots on the ground as a part of this operation. And again, a support role, even in terms of the strike missions that the NATO-led coalition is flying.
Great. The next question is from Lyra Rauch. The American troops is a difficult topic to tackle. The deployment was massive and a parallel economy was created. The question is the USA ready to bring back the troops and create the infrastructure to tend to all PTSD victims? How do you transition them back into society?
Well, it's a very important question. What we've had over the course of the last 10 years, as the president has said, is essentially a decade of war. We had the war in Afghanistan that began in 2002, but then really was attention was diverted from Afghanistan in 2003 when we went into Iraq with a much larger force than we did in Afghanistan. Where we are now is the wars are coming to an end. In Iraq, we've taken out over 100,000 troops to date, ended the combat mission that they have there, and we're scheduled to bring all of our troops out of Iraq and our military operation by the end of the year. So for all intents and purposes, the United States war in Iraq will be over. Afghanistan, we've begun to bring our troop levels down this year. Again, we've got about 100,000 troops there now, roughly, which again is, again, less than even the number of troops that have been brought back from Iraq. That'll be down by 10,000 at the end of this year. So at the end of this year, there'll be half as many troops in Iraq and Afghanistan as there were when President Obama took office. That number will continue to come down. 33,000 troops will be out of Afghanistan by the end of next summer. Reductions will continue after that. As we end the wars, though, an important part of what we need to do is care for those who've fought them. And as the question points out, the tour after tour after tour of duty that has been, carried out by our men and women in uniform has created some signature mental health issues associated with these wars. Traumatic brain injuries suffered, post-traumatic stress disorder. So what we've done is dramatically increased resources through the Department of Defense and in the VA to care for these wounds. We similarly, again, try to reduce the stigma of seeking care for them because, again, those who've gone through multiple tours of duty at war and in combat should feel that they have the resources to come forward and seek treatment for these types of mental health injuries. But we've also taken steps recently to make sure that when our men and women in uniform come home, when they leave the military service, that there's opportunity available for them here. We want to make sure that those who serve in our military are also able to participate in the nation building that needs to take place here at home and are able to access opportunity. So we have the 21st Century GI Bill, which allows for those who served in the United States military to go to college or to have their loved ones go to college. We want to make sure we're investing in their education. We also have a Veterans Employment Initiative that we've recently launched, which tries, again, to find ways to work with veterans and businesses to make sure that we're creating jobs for veterans, that we're matching them up with employment opportunities. So we want to make sure that we're going out of our way to do that. And again, similarly, part of the president's jobs bill that he puts forward increases those efforts to help veterans get jobs as well. So we want to end these wars. We want to bring our troops home. We want to make sure that they have the care that they need and the benefits that they need when they return home, including for issues like PTSD. And we also want to make sure that they're able to access opportunity, whether that's getting a college education or getting a job.
Okay, great. The next question again is from Better World. What was the most significant moment at UNGA for the president this year?
Well, you know, I think, frankly, that in terms of just the power of the moment, the Libyan meeting was hugely significant. And again, I think to appreciate it, you have to step back and look at the course of the last years and months. 2 years ago, when we first went to the UN, was when Gaddafi gave kind of a long, rambling presentation at the UNGA. He, at the time, was the most entrenched, longest-serving dictator in the world. 1 year ago, no one could have foreseen that there would have been the types of revolutions in the street that we've seen. 8 months ago, when the Libyan people started to protest, the Gaddafi regime unleashed a crackdown. It was just over 6 months ago that, acting at the U.S. urging, you saw a U.N. Security Council mandate and then an intervention to stop a massacre. And the notion that just over 6 months after that, you'd have the end of the Gaddafi regime, and then you'd be sitting at the United Nations and see a new flag raised. And at that meeting, the new Libyan flag was raised to symbolize the new government being in power and the new government being recognized as a representative of the Libyan people. That's an extraordinary powerful moment, especially because it wouldn't have been able to happen without the support of the international community. The Libyan people are the ones who brought about the change, but they needed the support that they got from the United States and the international community and the United Nations. So I think in terms of the power of the moment, sitting there, seeing a new Libyan flag raised, meeting with a new, again, leader of Libya, Chairman Abdel Jalil of the TNC, was a very powerful and significant moment for the president, and one that underscored the importance of the UN, underscored the importance of US leadership around the world, and underscored the power of people to bring about change in their countries, which is what the Libyan people did within Libya. And of course, there was also great interest in the Middle East peace issues, as there always is at the UNGA. So the president's ability to speak to that was a very important moment at UNGA this year, as it always is. But I think making clear our support for a two-state solution, but one that is negotiated, was an important moment for the president. But I do think that, again, it's important to step back and reflect on the improbability of seeing a new Libya seated at the UN, and the power of seeing that flag raised was quite important to the president, as was, I think, again, meeting with the newest member state at the UN, South Sudan.
Okay, our next question comes from Adrian Williams, who asks, what is the administration doing as it concerns its trade agreements to get our economy moving here again at home?
Sure. We have three trade agreements that we'd like to see passed by Congress. We have negotiated trade agreements with South Korea, with Colombia, with Panama. And if these trade agreements are put in place, we believe they'll do a lot to create jobs here in the United States. South Korea, for instance, is a large and growing market, growing economy. And passing this trade agreement, we think, will support tens of thousands of jobs here in the United States, allow us to sell goods like autos into Korean markets. So those three trade agreements are ones that we very much support and that we're working with Congress to see that they can get passed. Similarly, we're looking to expand our presence in the fastest growing markets in the world more generally in the Asia-Pacific region. So we're working with 10 other countries in the Asia-Pacific region to negotiate what we call a Trans-Pacific Partnership trade agreement. And this will be, again, a multilateral agreement in which many different countries participate, but they agree to meet high standards, and make sure we have labor and environmental protections built into these agreements, make sure that from the U.S. perspective, it's allowing us to export our goods to these markets. So that agreement is not yet negotiated, but it's something that we're pursuing in talks with many other countries. So as a general matter, we see trade agreements as ways to open up markets, to sell more U.S. goods abroad, which ultimately will create jobs here at home. Because we know that there's a lot of growth in emerging markets, whether they're in, again, the Asia-Pacific region or other places. And we want to make sure that we have agreements that allow us to access those markets.
Okay, I think we have time for one more question. And I think this is a related question to what you just answered. But what is the president's view on NAFTA and its impact on jobs going overseas? Does he have a plan to get those jobs back home?
Well, NAFTA, of course, was negotiated under the first Bush administration, ratified under the Clinton administration. Again, what it's done is created basically an economic community in North America with Canada and Mexico. I think what we've done insofar as we think that there are any problems in the enforcement of NAFTA, and in terms of imbalances that adversely affect U.S. workers. We've tried to raise this directly with our Canadian and Mexican partners. As a general matter, of course, we believe that that type of trade can support growth in North America broadly and growth in the United States. But I think we also want to learn from NAFTA and learn from the trade agreements of the past as we negotiate the trade agreements of the future. We want to make sure that, again, when we negotiate agreements, that they're good for American workers and good for American business. We want to make sure that they're opening markets to U.S. goods rather than just simply opening the American market to foreign goods, so that we, again, can do things like sell more automobiles in Korea and access other markets abroad. We want to make sure that they have standards, labor and environmental standards in place, again, that will protect the rights of workers, make sure that workers are not exploited, and that also protect our environment. And lastly, as we pursue trade agreements, also we want to make sure that we're supporting workers here at home, that they're getting the kind of training that they need to compete in a global economy, that they have the skills that they need to compete in a global economy where markets like this are open. So with NAFTA, again, I think it's a matter of, on a case-by-case basis, if there are issues where we think there are unfair imbalances or there are issues that we need to raise, we do that in the context of NAFTA and our relations with Canada and Mexico. But we also have learned from trade agreements of the past, as we negotiate trade agreements of the future, so that they're more advantageous to the American business and the American worker, and that they feed economic growth, just as they, again, bring together the global economy that's increasingly integrated.
Okay, well, that would conclude our web chat this afternoon. We'd like to thank Ben for taking the time for doing this today. Also, thank all of you for tuning in to this web chat. You can continue to follow us on whitehouse.gov. There will be a blog uploaded of this video probably within the hour. Additionally, there are fact sheets on the president's initiatives. There are also links to his speech on whitehouse.gov. So with that, this concludes the web chat, and we'll see you next time.
Thank you.